had two elections where abortion has really been cemented as a winning issue in Kentucky. We had a constitutional amendment last year that overwhelmingly turned out Kentuckians.
As we wrap up, Democratic Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear is set for inauguration today. Many say his race turned on a referendum and abortion.
Correct. Yes. Andy Beshear's race really turned on abortion. Moved people to vote on abortion access, where our Attorney General Daniel Cameron was one of the most restrictive attorney generals, similar to Ken Paxton, on abortion, and people turned out against him on abortion.
We have to leave it there. Tamara Weider, Kentucky State Director for Planned Parent Alliance Advocates, wearing a pin that says, bans off our bodies, and Dr. Bhavik Kumar, family medicine physician and abortion provider in Texas.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our end-of-year campaign. Help us meet our $75,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's different hues of independent programming are only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97214. Help shine some light on our radio community by donating now.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Tina Kotek releases the recommendations from her Downtown Portland Task Force. Oregon Energy customers face rate hikes from PGE and a worrying lawsuit from PacifiCorp. And a Nevada tribe loses their legal fight against a lithium mine on sacred land. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 12, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year campaign, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek released recommendations from her 40-plus person Portland Central City Task Force. They published 10 priority recommendations to be carried out early next year. The task force recommended enacting a 90-day state of emergency on fentanyl for the city, county, and state. That would include a ban on public drug use, something that was decriminalized by Measure 110. They also want to increase the cops and park rangers around the city and open more shelters and daytime services for the city's unhoused population. The increased push for services and outreach is notable, especially since the city of Portland is currently in a lawsuit over trying to ban people from camping outside who have nowhere else to go. The task force also recommended freezing business taxes for the next 3 years. The task force is not a government body and prominently featured many large business interests and excluded prominent local nonprofits and social service providers. The group also recommended creating a task force to evaluate if more tax breaks should be implemented for downtown businesses in the future. The plan was unveiled at the Oregon Business Plan Summit, an annual gathering of the state's business and political leaders. Since the task force was external to the government itself, its recommendations doesn't have the force of law, and it also meant that the meetings of the task force were closed to the media and the public. Portland General Electric will be raising customer rates by 17% come January. It's an eye-popping figure, and it follows a 2023 rate hike of 7%. The rate hike stems back to inflation and upgrades to the electric grid to help it be more resilient to wildfires and extreme weather. It's been in the works for a year or so, and it comes as other large power companies, like Pacific Power, have been found liable for damages in wildfires that started from their power lines. Oregonians may be eligible to get energy assistance with the Oregon Energy Fund. The fund assists those who make 70% or less than the statewide median income. The Oregon Energy Fund has a directory of where people can find more information to get discounts on their utility bills on their website, OregonEnergyFund.org. Oregon groups are fighting for consumer rights against PacifiCorp's proposal to limit lawsuit awards. Advocates argue that the electric company's request endangers customer rights and protects company investors. Shantia Hudson has the details.
Groups in Oregon are fighting for consumer rights in the face of what they call a concerning request from PacifiCorp, the state's largest electricity provider. Earlier this year, PacifiCorp asked the Oregon Public Utility Commission to set limits on future lawsuit awards, restricting payments to actual damages for property and loss of life. This request, according to Jagjeet Nagra with the Oregon Consumer Justice Group, puts consumers' rights in jeopardy.
Because essentially what they're saying is that if you want electricity, you have to, you the consumer, have to take the risk, not just of us being negligent, as the jury found this, you know, earlier, but also for us being recklessly indifferent to causing harm to our customers.
Nagra says the company's request protects its investors. He argues that removing non-punitive damages relieves PacifiCorp of responsibility and denies consumers the ability to seek adequate remedies for their losses. He points out the filing came out after a Multnomah County jury found PacifiCorp liable for wildfires that occurred on Labor Day of 2020 and ordered them to pay nearly $72 million in damages to the victims. Mike Goetz from the Oregon Citizens Utility Board shares the concern and says that allowing customers to pursue damages ensures utilities operate their systems safely. He explains that for his organization, one major concern lies in the legality of PacifiCorp's filing.
We feel that there are legal issues related to the filing and that it may not be either within the scope of the Oregon Commission's authority to grant a filing like this, and that such a broad and sweeping liability waiver may not be eventually enforceable by Oregon courts.
Another important aspect is the growing threat of wildfires due to climate change. Goetz emphasizes the need for utilities to make responsible operational changes given the increasing risk associated with wildfires.
Utilities no doubt will have to invest in their system and make sure that they're operating it in a safe way to minimize their role in starting and spreading wildfires, and to also make sure that their system is resilient to wildfires that are caused not by their doing.
Overall, he says the issue comes down to fairness between large corporations like PacifiCorp and consumers who often lack alternatives. Oregon Consumer Justice and Oregon Citizens Utility Board both intend to intervene in the proceedings to protect customers' rights and amplify the voices of those impacted or potentially affected in the future. For Oregon News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
Oregon Secretary of State LaVon Griffin-Vallade says former President Donald Trump will remain on the state's primary election ballot. A review by the state's Department of Justice advised her that she did not have the authority to determine whether presidential primary candidates are qualified. But last week, the advocacy group Free Speech for People filed a lawsuit with the Oregon Supreme Court. The group seeks to have the Supreme Court require Griffin-Vallade to disqualify Trump from the primary and general election ballots or demonstrate why she shouldn't be required to do so. The group maintains that Trump is ineligible because of the 14th Amendment, which states that anyone who took an oath to uphold the Constitution, who then engaged in insurrection or rebellion, is unqualified to hold office. The group believes that the Oregon Secretary of State has the responsibility to vet candidates. They reference Griffin-Vallade's disqualification of four Republican state senators who missed more than 10 floor sessions, and former Secretary Shamia Fagan's disqualification of Nicholas Kristof's run for governor because he did not meet the residency requirements. The suit says that, quote, Oregon law leaves the secretary no neutral position. A spokesperson for Griffin-Vallade said that the secretary stands by her decision but will follow any direction from the court. The State Department of Natural Resources just delivered a report to the legislature on plans to restore eelgrass and kelp beds along the Washington state coast. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Bull kelp in South and Central Puget Sound has declined more than 90% over the last 150 years, and eelgrass meadows severely declined as well, according to a new report just delivered to lawmakers. The Washington Department of Natural Resources' new plan aims to reverse the losses. The DNR's Cynthia Harbison says the goal is to conserve and recover at least 10,000 acres of kelp and eelgrass habitat by 2040.
So we're at the beginning of this process in the next few years. We are going to be working to gather local knowledge and identify specific conservation and recovery sites.
Three general areas will host pilot projects: Grays Harbor, South Puget Sound, and the Eastern Strait of Juan de Fuca. The DNR will convene public stakeholder meetings early next year. Go to their website to sign up to be notified by email for details. Harbison says eelgrass and kelp are crucial habitat for many species, especially juvenile salmon and Dungeness crab, and can help in the fight against climate change.
Eelgrass is really good at storing carbon, and it can also provide some physical shoreline stabilization with the sediment and also wave reduction when there's big storm events coming in. Kelp can also do that as well.
Eelgrass and kelp are under stress from rising water temperatures due to climate change, as well as invasive species, water pollution, and shoreline development. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Washington News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Sammy's Law aims to slow drug sales on social media. The Texas Supreme Court rules against an emergency abortion, but the woman leaves the state to get one. Special counsel Jack Smith seeks a ruling on former President Trump's immunity while Trump doubles down on his dictatorship comments. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
February 7th, 2021, Super Bowl Sunday, when we came to find our son that day, he was dead on the floor.
Sam Chapman's 16-year-old son, Sammy, died from fentanyl bought through social media, which Chapman says was delivered to the house like a pizza.
As I walk through the halls of Congress with his ashes around my neck.
Chapman and his wife, Dr. Laura Bernman, are lobbying Congress for Sammy's Law, which would force social media to let third-party software give parents a way to monitor their children's accounts. Kate Cox, a Dallas mother of two pregnant with a fetus that has nearly no chance of survival, has left Texas to get the emergency abortion she was denied in the state. Texas District Judge Maya Guerra Gamble last week ruled Cox could terminate her pregnancy, but that decision was overturned. Gamble says Cox needs the procedure to protect her chances of having children in the future.
The idea that Ms. Cox wants desperately to be a parent, and this law might actually cause her to lose that ability, is shocking.
The Iowa caucus is just 5 weeks away, and a new Des Moines Register poll shows former President Donald Trump leads the GOP field by more than 50 points. Last week, Trump told Fox News he would be a dictator for the first day if he got back into office. At an event this weekend in New York, he doubled down.
Dictator for one day. But the New York Times said, and you know why I wanted to be a dictator? Because I want a wall, right? I want a wall, and I want to drill, drill, drill.
Meanwhile, special counsel Jack Smith is asking the Supreme Court to rule on Trump's claim that presidential immunity protects the former president's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The judge in that trial reacted harshly to Trump's claims of immunity, saying a former chief executive does not get a lifetime get-out-of-jail-free card just for holding the office. President Joe Biden and Ukraine's leader Volodymyr Zelensky will meet at the White House today as the administration presses Congress to provide more aid to Kiev. Zelensky spoke at the National Defense University in Washington yesterday.
America and all three nations need to be confident in their strengths, in their leadership, so that dictatorships doubt themselves when the free world hesitates. That's when dictatorships celebrate.
The Air National Guard is punishing 15 service members following an intel leak on the social media platform Discord. The Guard says their carelessness let Airman Jack Teixeira spread secrets, including details about U.S. spy satellites, phone intercepts of Russian generals, and information about North Korean drones. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's For the Wild. Then at 7, Keeping Democracy Alive. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1963, Kenya declares its independence from Great Britain. The quote of the day is from American abolitionist and journalist William Lloyd Garrison, who said, quote, "With reasonable men, I will reason. With humane men, I will plead. But to tyrants, I will give no quarter, not waste arguments where they will certainly be lost." A Nevada tribe says it will end its legal fight against the Thacker Pass lithium mine, which is planned to be located on a sacred site. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Reno Sparks Indian Colony says it will end its legal fight against a lithium mine on sacred land after a Nevada court dismissed the tribe's lawsuit. The Thacker Pass lithium mine would be located at the site of a village that was massacred. Christina Onnested reports.
We didn't lose the lawsuit because we were wrong. We lost the lawsuit because the law favors mining.
Reno Sparks Indian Colony Chair Arlen Melendez says to continue a legal fight against the Thacker Pass lithium mine would be costly and take too long.
By the time you would get through to appeal, they would have already desecrated all of the sacred sites.
But the Washoe, Paiute, and Shoshone tribes that make up the colony aren't giving up the fight. Melendez says the next phase will be a public awareness campaign about the $2 billion project, the largest open-pit lithium mine in North America, to produce electric vehicle batteries in the push to transition off fossil fuels and combat climate change. Will Falk is the tribe's lawyer.
This project is absolutely a fossil fuel-based project. They're going to burn 12,000 gallons of diesel and gasoline on site every single day to operate the Thacker Pass lithium mine. There's going to be over 152,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions every single year. That's the size of a small city.
The lithium will go to General Motors, which invested $650 million in the parent company, Lithium Americas, earlier this year. GM is maker of the electric Hummer, a large SUV that's predicted to emit more emissions than a gas-powered sedan, according to the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, a nonprofit climate research center. There are more than 21,000 other lithium mining claims in the state of Nevada, according to the Nevada Division of Minerals. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for National Native News.
In Utah, a group of educators at Brigham Young University is working with the 8 sovereign nations in the state to create lessons that reflect what tribes want taught about them. KUER's Martha Harris went to a classroom to see one of those lessons in action.
Ready? Listen and then repeat.
Brenda Bial is visiting a third grade class at Spanish Oaks Elementary in Spanish Fork. She's teaching the students how to say words in Navajo. It's her native language. Bial is Dene, a member of the Navajo Nation. The students are learning the song Shinasha. What makes this lesson unique is it has the Navajo Nation's stamp of approval. It's a part of BYU's Native American Curriculum Initiative. The project started because of what Bial heard from teachers. Educators wanted help knowing what's appropriate to teach about indigenous people. So Bial and her colleagues started creating lesson plans.
It was important that we actually go to the sovereign nations and we ask them, what would you like the children of Utah to know about your ways?
Bial says every single tribe wanted kids to know that they are still here. They're not historical figures.
But then after that, every one of them has a different topic or content that they want children to know.
Bial says many lessons treat Indigenous people as having one singular viewpoint.
Within Utah, there are 8 sovereign nations with 8 different ways of viewing things, different cultural ways, different arts.
In these lessons, students are not just learning about the sovereign nations and their history. They're learning from them and through their perspectives. In Salt Lake City, I'm Martha Harris.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
One Arizona State University researcher explains why humility is so important within the medical profession. He encourages those in medical settings to consider themselves as part of a team, including patients. Alex Gonzalez has more on the story.
A researcher at Arizona State University is shedding light on the importance of humility within the medical field. Barrett Michalek is a research associate professor of nursing and health innovation at ASU. He contends that humility in the healthcare setting is paramount and considers it to be enacted when medical providers not only acknowledge their abilities and limitations, but also see each other as part of a team. He says it's important for team members to have a shared goal in mind and include the patient and their possible caregivers as part of it as well.
So understanding that, you know, doctors understanding that nurses have shared, you know, have understandings and expertise, as well as physical therapists and clinical social workers, but also patients. Patients bring in their own knowledge and their own experiences and should be part of that as well. All those elements make it essential.
Michalek recognizes there's an occupational status hierarchy within healthcare and says it plays out every day. But he adds that he witnessed a display of humility when the doctor, the doula, and his wife all helped in delivering his son. He says neither medical professional tried to assert dominance over the other and most importantly included his wife and listened to her needs. Michalek says humility is on the radar of many in the educational and medical field, but adds more could be done to value the positive impacts of enacting it. He adds that current studies find clinicians' humility not only helps mitigate the burnout those in the field can experience, but it also positively impacts patients' trust and satisfaction with regards to the care they receive. Michalek argues one of the issues is whether humility is being taught effectively.
And when I'm saying teaching it, I mean, you know, formally in kind of curriculum of medical education or residency or nursing education, or are we also teaching it through role modeling? And usually that's where the push has been. Well, it'll be modeled by those that the students are seeing, the health profession students are seeing. Okay. But we don't necessarily see that as the case.
Michalek says the lack of humility in today's healthcare landscape can be partially attributed to systemic issues such as competition for patients, money, or superiority. He adds patients should feel empowered about their own level of knowledge and not be afraid to ask questions or express concerns to better solicit a culture of humility. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Dual-use solar is becoming a bigger part of helping New York reach its climate goals. This means putting solar panels in places aside from a field and making better use of the land they're on. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
New York is looking at different ways to make use of where to place solar panels. The practice of dual-use solar uses solar panels in a variety of forms, ranging from shade canopies for cars to a house's awning. But this is becoming a common agrivoltaic practice. Solar panels are being installed on farmland growing crops or home to livestock production. Kyle Rabin with the Alliance for Clean Energy New York describes some opportunities agrivoltaics and dual-use solar can have.
Agrivoltaics can provide much-needed revenue for New York's farmers and improve the quality of farmland that plays host to solar projects. Even on its own, solar projects can have the benefit of protecting farmland from other more permanent uses of that land.
An Alliance for Clean Energy New York report finds almost 69,000 acres of farmland will be used for dual-use solar by 2030. This will be more than double by the time New York is supposed to be using 100% renewable electricity in 2050. Solar developers can take advantage of the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority's Renewable Energy Certificate Program. This allows solar developers to compete for long-term state contracts with an incentive to use farmland for solar projects. But Rabin says the limited incentives pose a challenge.
For New York State, which is already doing so much to explore this area and facilitate its growth, to have policies that can incentivize both landowners, farmers, and solar developers to help ensure a smooth transition to this co-utilization of farmland.
Lawmakers put forward legislation to establish an agrivoltaics viability pilot program. The bill's goal was to protect soil health during construction and decommissioning of solar arrays, use sustainable agricultural production practices, and study commercialization of these projects. However, the bill failed to make it out of committee. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
COP28, the International Conference on Climate Change, is unlikely to advance serious measures to combat the threat. The Middle East oil producers are unilaterally opposed to phasing out fossil fuels, even as carbon dioxide released from fossil fuels continues to rise. Eliminating methane emissions seems to be one common goal. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone.
International conferences almost always fall well short of meeting ambitious reform goals because the large number and variety of participants ensures hard bargaining over policy ideas and details. The annual COP28, COP4, Conference of the Parties, meetings in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, are no different, but their chances of breaking new ground for dealing with climate change are further reduced by the conference's leadership. The chairman, Sultan Al Jaber, heads the UAE's state oil and gas company. His comment at the conference that, quote, there is no science out there that says the phase out of fossil fuel is what's going to achieve 1.5 degrees centigrade, showed where he stands and where the fossil fuel industry as a whole wants to enter center discussion. Yet crossing that threshold could happen this year. COP28 follows the script of previous conferences. The UN, represented by Secretary General Antonio Guterres, opened with a plea for saving the planet from an immediate threat. Everyone present professed worry, but when the parties got down to outlining agreements, the goodwill faded, replaced by self-interested demands. Thus, when Guterres, in response to Al Jaber, said that phasing out fossil fuels with a clear time frame is essential to fighting climate change, he could expect no support from industry or government. In fact, the OPEC cartel declared its members would block any proposal aimed at reducing fossil fuel use. COP28 has had a few redeeming features. Reportedly, the 50 biggest fossil fuel companies have together agreed to eliminate methane emissions from their drilling and production work. If they fulfill that pledge, it will be a big deal, since methane is far more destructive to the environment than carbon dioxide. Fred Krupp, president of the Environmental Defense Fund, says if those promises are met, it's got the potential to cut temperatures we would otherwise see within the next decade, more than anything agreed to at prior COPs, more than anything I've seen in my entire career over 30 years. Also potentially important is a new fund set up specifically to address loss and damage to developing countries from climate change. This took years of negotiations. Rich countries have pledged $655 million into the fund so far, although hundreds of billions of dollars are needed per year. The value of the fund will depend on whether or not local communities, not just central governments, actually receive the money. After all, the damage to economies is mostly at the local level, where homes have been wiped out and residents have no way to rebuild. The central problem remains governments that don't meet their responsibilities and fossil fuel companies that don't fulfill their promises. Carbon dioxide released from burning fossil fuel is expected to rise by 1.1% in 2023 compared with 2022, scientists find in a new study. Researchers from the Global Carbon Project announced the results at COP28. Just supporting in renewables alone is not going to solve the climate problem, said Glenn Peters, a senior researcher in Oslo and one of the 121 authors of the report. You have to have policies that are ensuring that fossil fuels actually go down, just as Secretary General Guterres said. The COVID years produced a measurable decrease in carbon emissions, but that has proved to be misleading. Rising carbon emissions is the rule, led by China, over 4% increase expected this year, and India, over 8%. Fossil fuel use has declined in the US, Japan, Brazil, and the European Union, but those countries together represent only 28% of carbon emissions from fossil fuel use. Unless all countries are decarbonizing together, experts say, we'll never stop the carbon buildup. By the way, the US has nothing to crow about. It is now second only to Saudi Arabia as an oil exporter and producer. Among the measures proposed for dealing with the problem is an old one. Give developing countries the resources to adopt renewable energy counterweights to climate change. But that leaves China out, since it really isn't a poor developing country and has plenty of money to move away from fossil fuels. China is doing that to some degree, but it remains heavily reliant on coal, and new coal-firing plants are still being built, contrary to Xi Jinping's assurances a few years ago. COP28 will no doubt end with a common statement of intent to do more. But again, as in past conferences, mechanisms are lacking to hold the parties to their pledges and provide oversight of actual carbon-fighting efforts. That's why we rely so heavily on environmental activist groups and individuals. They are doing the job others refuse to take on. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 12, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Nate Kapp, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Shantia Hudson, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. I'm Eric Leuschner. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year campaign, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. Well, it's dark, it's cold, and it is very rainy, and we may be a couple weeks from the solstice as of this recording, but for my money, we've definitely entered another Coast Range winter. I love to use this time of year to reflect and take stock, so I figured it was a great time to invite the Coast Range Association's Executive Director, Chuck Willer, back for our annual Year in Review.